Welcome to the Let's Clear the Air Energy Podcast. Conversations focused on how some of the world's top energy leaders are innovating to deliver clean, affordable, and reliable energy for the future.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for joining us on the latest edition of the Let's Clear the Air Energy Podcast. As always, I'm joined with Stuart Salters and Brian Nix, the co-hosts here. And today we have a really special guest, Sam Boxerman. He's a recognized leader in environmental law and a partner at Sydney Austin, which has 4 decades of expertise. Sam has built a distinguished career defending clients in environmental litigation, regulatory matters. His work spans the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, and a variety of other acronyms that I'm sure we will get into. He's known for guiding clients through complex government investigation and enforcement actions. So before joining Sydney Austin in 1991, he served as at the U.S. Department of Justice, where he prosecuted environmental enforcement cases and served as a special assistant to the U.S. attorney. Sam, your insights go across many industries. We're very thankful for you to be here. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Yeah, definitely. So we like to kick it off with a sort of a personal question just so our listeners can get to know you. And to put a timestamp kind of on this podcast, here we are a week removed from the July 4th holiday. So how was your 4th? What did you do for the 4th? Are you a lake person? Are you a parking lot fireworks viewer? What did you do that day?
I'm a beach person. We had a great 4th. We went to a small town in Delaware, on the Delaware Bay, called Lewis, Delaware. And we had what I would consider to be sort of a very Americana 4th of July. There's a boat parade. There's a canal that goes through the town. There's a boat parade. People decorate their boats, a lot of American flags and costumes and red, white, and blue. And then at night, there's a fireworks display. We just walk down to the beach and they shoot them off over the bay. So the weather was picture perfect all weekend. We were very lucky. So it was nice to get away from DC for a few days.
Nice.
That sounds like a pretty good 4th. Excellent. Well, Brian, you want to kick things off here on some of the questions?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll just start real basic here for everybody listening. EPA, another acronym, Environmental Protection Agency. So, yeah, just on the basic level, what is the EPA and, you know, what are its core responsibilities?
Sure. U.S. EPA, it's a federal administrative agency. Its stated mission is to protect human health and the environment. And its core responsibilities, I would say, is to develop regulations and then enforce those regulations and the federal environmental laws. So, I mean, if you think of the Congress as the one that passes the environmental laws, whether it's the Clean Air Act or the Clean Water Act or one of the other acronyms that we'll get into, Congress then directs the president, or in this case, often EPA directly, to implement that law. And it does that by promulgating rules and enforcing them. I mean, it does a few other things. The budget of EPA actually includes a lot of money for grants to states or other institutions for a variety of projects and issues. They've got a whole research arm, the Office of Research and Development, that looks at issues related to air quality, water quality, risk assessment, chemicals, that sort of thing. And it also has some partnerships. I certainly don't profess to know all of them, but there are quite a few of them. I mean, if you have an appliance and it's got an Energy Star label on it, that's a partnership between EPA and those manufacturers on Energy Star. That's just one. There are many others. But that's the gist. Really, it's core regulatory development and enforcement, and then sort of the other related issues.
Okay. And so they're, you know, federal agency. The states have, I believe, each state has its own environmental enforcement agency as well. So can you talk a little bit about how that's split up there?
Sure. I mean, it's interesting. Historically, the Congress has been very much in favor of federalism, consistent with our sort of way of government. So in the case, let's just say the Clean Air Act, authority is given to EPA, but then EPA has the ability to authorize or delegate states to implement aspects of the Clean Air Act. And they do that by issuing their own regulations that then have to be approved by US EPA, and they get put into a collection of regulations known as the State Implementation Plan, or SIP. And so there's a shared responsibility for applying that particular law between the federal government and state governments. The states also can pass their own laws and have their own enforcement arms to both enforce their state implementation plan as well as their own state laws. So it's a shared, very much a federalism type relationship in the environmental space.
Yeah. So the states can be more stringent and strict than what EPA would require, but they can't be less. Is that correct?
That is a good way to put it. States can definitely impose additional requirements beyond what the federal law requires. And so, yeah, they can be more stringent as long as they meet the minimum that's established under the federal law.
Thanks. So, Sam, like, for somebody listening, I mean, obviously, we've got some in our audience that work in our industry, and maybe they deal with environmental compliance. And so they're probably asleep by now. But for some that aren't in our industry, or some that maybe are in another part of our industry, whether construction or integrity or something like that, how does the EPA impact? And if you're okay answering it kind of twofold, how would the EPA impact someone? You talked about the appliances, like that's an obvious impact, impacting what appliances we're able to buy, or if we want some kind of rebate or incentive, what appliances we want to buy. But like, what are other ways EPA's regulations impact the public? And then kind of what are ways EPA's regulations would impact our industry?
Okay. Let's take the first one. Yeah, there are many ways that EPA, their work shows up in our daily lives. So I'm in my office today. I've returned to the office. At the end of the day, I'll get in my car, drive home. In my car, I've got an old internal combustion engine, no EV. So as I burn gasoline, there are going to be emissions associated with my car. Those are regulated by EPA under Title II of the Clean Air Act. And there are all these, there's software and hardware in your cars now that, restrict the emissions. So I show up at my house, I go inside, I flip on the light, the electricity is turning on the light. The electricity comes from the power plant. I don't have solar panels on my house, so I'm getting electricity from the local power plant, which burns coal. And, the emissions from the coal plant are regulated by EPA, and a lot of the other aspects of that operation are subject to EPA.
Yeah, I was going to say, try and buy an incandescent light bulb right now.
Yeah.
You can't really find them, right? It's all LEDs these days.
Exactly. So, I mean, that's partly from incentives that are tied to EPA policies. Yeah, I mean, there are others. You go drink water from the faucet. That's regulated by the Safe Drinking Water Act. They set standards. When we went out to watch the fireworks, it's at dusk. I'm the one who wants to, layer myself with the latest insect repellent. And, there's a whole federal statute that governs insecticides and fungicides and all those good things. And those have to be reviewed and approved by US EPA. And there's a registration number and so on and so forth associated with a lot of consumer products. So really, in so many ways in our everyday life, we are there are things that EPA has a hand in one way or another. As far as, the midstream industry, that's a much larger in sort of complex set of requirements that EPA has. So, any operator is going to be subject to federal regulations. Am I operating, a natural gas processing plant, or am I operating any sort of gathering lines or any aspect of the midstream operations? They're going to be subject to EPA regulations. So, the emissions are going to be regulated under the Clean Air Act regulations that regulate methane. There's leak detection and repair requirements. There are hazardous air pollutant requirements. So, all the emissions are regulated, and then any waste that's generated in the course of the operations that needs to be disposed of, those have to comply with federal and state requirements under the Resource Conservation Recovery Act. You know, if we're building something and we're going to disturb a wetland, we're going to have to comply with the Clean Water Act and get the appropriate permits and maybe also state approvals. So, you know, throughout the course of any operation, there are going to be Air Act, Water Act. You know, if you're interfering at all with an endangered species, you're going to have, and you're building something, you're going to have to deal with that. So it's pretty expansive when you're thinking about our industry and how it's regulated by these various federal laws.
Yeah, no, that's good. I guess just to kind of follow up, and I like the bug spray example as someone that lives in the swamp in DC. There are lots of mosquitoes in my backyard this time of the year. But I mean, there's balance, right? I mean, I don't want to get carried off by the mosquitoes in my yard, but at the same time, I don't want to put anything on my skin or my kid's skin that is going to, you know, be dangerous. And same with our industry, right? Like, we recognize the energy the midstream operators provide meets a need. Turn on the lights, you know, if it's a kind of a liquid processing facility or a liquid gathering line, like eventually gets to the fuel that we put in our car. And so I guess, could you explain a little bit about how EPA goes about striking that balance of economic benefit, you know, good for Americans, as well as, you know, protecting the environment, protecting the bugs and the bunnies?
Yeah, interesting question. I'll have to say it sort of depends a little bit because, you know, as a general matter, EPA to some extent does try to balance off, I think, environmental protection with sort of the interest of stakeholders who can provide comments on a proposed regulation. And so they take those into account, those economic and stakeholder interests. But you know, to a certain extent, it depends on the statute as to whether or not EPA is technically authorized to consider costs and economic issues in deciding what it does or doesn't do. Dating back to the Reagan administration and then the Clinton administration, there are executive orders that have come out of the White House that direct agencies like EPA to assess costs and benefits. And so if you pull out when you have insomnia and you want to pull out the Federal Register and read through some preambles and final rules, you'll see, you know, references to a regulatory impact analysis. And so those are part of any, you know, economically significant rule. And so that will assess in some detail the economics associated with a particular rule. And EPA is to take that into account in its decision making. But there are some things that they're not allowed to. So they set national ambient air quality standards under the Clean Air Act. Well, the statute actually says you're not supposed to consider costs in setting those standards. On the other hand, the Safe Drinking Water Act explicitly says thou shalt consider cost benefit. And so in setting those standards, they're actually required to. The current administration is definitely pushing towards more consideration of cost in evaluating the need for a regulation. The president issued an executive order pretty early on in the administration, directing, you know, I forgot exactly the title of that particular executive order, but it was directed at a deregulatory agenda, encouraging costs to be considered in a number of ways. I mean, one is if for every regulation that's issued, the agency needs to identify 10 that it proposes to repeal. The Office of Management and Budget is expected to evaluate the overall costs of each agency's set of regulations. They're going to be setting out essentially regulatory budgets for each agency starting next year so that agencies don't increase. There's actually, in the first Trump administration, there was an effort to sort of keep the cost at zero. In this administration, the executive order actually says to significantly reduce the overall cost of regulation. So there's a clear desire now to do even more to consider the effect on American industry, on innovation, on competitiveness and development. It'll be interesting to see exactly how that plays out. I'm sure there are those who will say this goes beyond what EPA can do and other agencies, and there'll be some court fights about it.
without getting too political on sides or whatever, but just given any administration and how long you've kind of been in the business, what do you see are kind of the differences and how are they, you know, similar or different, you know, under each kind of administration, starting with Trump, I guess, working our way backwards?
Well, maybe we compare Trump to Biden, sort of. If Biden is the classic Democratic side of the equation and Trump the Republican side of the equation, I'd sort of put it in three buckets, if I can use that phrase. I guess that's sort of how I would look at it. I mean, one is different approach to regulation. The executive order that I just mentioned sort of reflects a mindset that we don't need more regulation. We need less regulation. We need to encourage development, innovation. You know, I think the term that's used is, you know, unleash energy opportunities in America, that sort of thing. That's the clear direction from this administration. And you know, the administrator of EPA announced an intention to revisit or reconsider, rescind over 30 regulations that had come out during Biden and Obama. So I think an approach to regulation, the Biden EPA was on the other extreme of the spectrum, you know, very aggressive expansion of the regulatory footprint and across all of the aspects of what EPA did. So a very different approach there. I'd say the second bucket is climate. I mean, climate and regulation of greenhouse gas emissions and all things climate was a priority for the Biden administration, no doubt. And it was very, you know, throughout EPA's efforts and other aspects of the administration.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, we've seen pretty clearly from the president's executive orders, from statements by the administrator of EPA, by the steps they've taken so far to propose to rescind the power plant greenhouse gas emissions rule, from what we're hearing is being considered related to the endangerment finding for greenhouse gas emissions, that, you know, this is a clear pivot for the Trump administration and particularly Trump EPA to focus on the more traditional environmental issues of air and water and waste and not to be focused on greenhouse gas emissions and climate in the same way that Biden was and Obama, I think, to a lesser extent. I'd say the third thing is, at least so far, is aggressive enforcement. You know, Biden was particularly aggressive in enforcement. And what we're seeing so far is an administration that is not nearly as aggressive as Biden was. And, you know, I'm kind of hopeful that it's going to be a more collaborative approach to finding solutions that will, you know, provide environmental protection in a sensible and reasonable way, as opposed to, you know, taking out the hammer and trying to impose, you know, the most aggressive penalties and relief that really limits, you know, a lot of what America offers. So, I mean, I think those are sort of the three ways that I see a different approach under this EPA and this administration as opposed to the previous one. And I think it's pretty representative of how the pendulum has swung back and forth between and amongst administrations.
So Sam, I always found something interesting. We have the laws on the books, Clean Air, Clean Water Act, they kind of define all these things, but the EPA seems to have a lot of discretion over the regulations that they, you know, come up with and enforce, which kind of varies, like you just mentioned, in between administration and administration. Can you speak more to that on just how much leeway they actually have on developing regulations and whether or not that's actually, you know, a law that was passed, or is it just from the original laws that gave the power of EPA to do that?
Great question. I would say, you know, there are some things that are spelled out in the statute. You know, thou shalt issue a regulation on X. The Congress would have been very prescriptive in what the agency must do and must do by a certain date. You know, in the world of power plants, the Clean Air Act was amended back in 1990, and there were specific requirements for the acid rain program to install pollution controls, and there were dates and requirements. It was very prescriptive. And so EPA then would implement based on those pretty clear directions from the Congress. But in a lot of other areas, they have more discretion to exercise their judgment. So, I mean, you know, establishing what the right way, if at all, to regulate methane emissions, you know, there's a lot of discretion on how you might do that. It's not set out in the statute. You know, they're supposed to use, you know, best demonstrated technologies, but, you know, how that's determined is based on a balancing test. And, you know, then they're monitoring and record keeping reporting. They have a lot of leeway as to what would be the appropriate way to monitor, keep records and report on those sorts of things. So they have some things that they must do by a date certain, and it's pretty spelled out. But in a lot of other ways, I think you're right, there's a lot of discretion here. And there's usually some criteria set out in the particular provision of the statute that the agency is applying. But within that, they have a lot of room to apply their own judgment, their own assessment of the data. And yeah, that's why you see such variability, I think, between and among administrations historically.
I mean, I think we've touched on two of the three branches of government. And so, Sam, just curious, what is the role of the courts when it comes to EPA regs?
Yeah, I was thinking about that, and I meant to say something in response to Brian's question. It's a great add-on there, because, you know, we saw last term, you know, again, getting a little nerdy in the weeds of the world of administrative law, but, you know, there was the decision by the Supreme Court in Loper-Bright, which reversed an earlier Supreme Court case referred to as Chevron, which provided some measure of deference in the case of a statute that was determined to be ambiguous to the agency's interpretation of the law. But Loper-Bright eliminated that deference. And so I think what we might see from the courts is the courts not, you know, there'll still be some deference to EPA's technical expertise depending upon the particular situation and what exactly the statute provides. But I think we will see the courts jumping in and saying, no, that's not what we think the statute says. And we're not going to defer to you, EPA, on how you are interpreting the statute in the same way that they may have before. I don't want to suggest that there's not going to be any deference. I think there's still going to be some, at least as of now. I mean, obviously the case law is evolving, but I think we will see the courts more willing to say, well, that's what we think the statute says and means. And that could have implications for how the courts review particular EPA actions.
So we talked a little bit about enforcement. You know, if a company does violate it, what does that enforcement look like today?
Yeah, I mean, whether something becomes a federal case, you know, we're going to make a federal case out of it, really does depend on whether, you know, the nature of the violation or the particular statute. There's also a lot of, to Brian's point, there's a lot of discretion here as to, you know, what enforcement authority the agency may use. But they do have some pretty expansive powers. So if there's a violation of the law, EPA can proceed with a civil enforcement action. They can do that either administratively, or they can do that through the courts. Or if it's a particularly serious situation and they believe there's intentional violations of the law, they do have the ability to proceed with a criminal enforcement matter. But that's not the most typical. The most common one is civil enforcement. It usually starts with EPA gathering information. They have broad information gathering authority under most of the environmental laws. So they could do that either by, you know, coming to your facility, knocking on the door and saying, we're here for an inspection. We want to see your records. We want to gather some data. Or they can send you a letter, dear facility, please search your records for the last 5 years for these 50 items. And there, it's pretty expansive. And also, as you all know, I mean, there's a lot of reporting that's done. And so it may be that in the course of filing a lot of reports, there's information that says there's a noncompliance. So they gather all this information and then they can decide whether or not they think there's a violation. And if there is, they can decide again whether they want to proceed with enforcement. They could issue a notice of violation or an NOV. And then there's a whole process then for engagement between the alleged violator and the EPA to decide how to proceed. You know, the facility could say, we didn't violate the law and here are all the reasons why we didn't. Or that was then, we fixed it, and there's a back and forth. And typically these things get resolved. They get resolved usually in an administrative consent agreement. between the facility and the EPA. There may be a penalty associated with that. EPA has the ability to demand civil penalties. If it's a bigger deal, then they'll refer the matter to the Department of Justice. And if there's a resolution, then it's done in court. There's a more formal process of filing a complaint and then a consent decree. So that could happen in that way as well. You know, you don't settle, then there you can fight it out either in federal court or if it's an administrative process through an administrative proceeding.
Interesting.
So does the reliance on the reporting, does that typically come from the states that are doing that? Or is that, do they rely on their own federal, you know, the say midstream industry doing federal reporting, or how does that kind of work?
Yeah, a little bit of both. The regulations or the permit that governs the particular facility or operation will likely have a requirement to submit data. We conducted our monitoring and collected these data, and the data show whatever they show. And here's our Excel spreadsheet for the 20 monitoring events that we did. And, you know, if there's a violation of some sort as a result of that, it all gets packaged up and sent off to the regulators. I should say that the sort of on the ground first line regulator typically is the state agency. They're usually the permitting issuing authority. And so this information is typically sent to them first, and EPA would get a copy. And so it's more likely that if there's an incident that requires some enforcement resolution, you know, unless it's a major issue, it's more likely to be addressed by a state agency. And EPA has oversight. They can come in if they choose to, but, as a general matter, this information comes into EPA through these, unless they're gathering the information themselves. It's possible that the state sends out its inspector. The state, again, is more the on-the-ground regulator. They tend to visit these facilities depending upon resources. They may come once a year to a facility, whereas EPA may only come once every several years. So the state inspector goes out there, gathers information. Maybe they determine that they find some information that suggests noncompliance, and they may send that off to EPA, and then EPA can decide, you know, if it wants to do something with it.
Hey, Sam, I've got a question for you. Actually, I have a bunch, but I'll ask this one just because I think it's a little more of a developing situation. So, you know, a big part of what the midstream industry does, you know, there are emissions associated with it. And by all means, the operators are doing what they can to mitigate those emissions, find and fix leaks. But there are some that happen that they haven't found, or maybe you're just small and they're on the list to be fixed, but they're just prioritizing appropriately. But there's a lot of people or a lot of companies or organizations, I guess, that are looking for these leaks, you know, satellites, drones, you know, whatever it might be. I mean, what is the interaction between like a EPA and maybe a group that has its own satellite monitoring these emissions? And I mean, is there a relationship or what, you know, kind of explain a little bit about what is all going on in that regard?
Yeah. I'd be interested to see what's happening now in this administration. I would think in the previous administration, the relationship was pretty close. And my assumption was that sort of information was provided. There was sort of a regular pipeline, no pun intended, directly from those entities to state and federal regulators. You know, if they had information suggesting that there was a significant leak or any leak, you know, they would be providing that information to the regulators and encouraging them to take action. But they have their own ability, depending upon the nature of the issue, to pursue a citizen's suit claim. So if there's particularly the large environmental groups that have the resources to have a satellite or drone or other information gathering effort, they could potentially pursue their own claims as a citizen under the Clean Air Act, you know, assuming they could establish standing to bring the case. So there is the whole question about the super emitter program under the revised regulation governing methane and how EPA is going to consider that information and make sure that it's in fact consistent with good science and they're going to vet it. I mean, that was the idea. I guess we'll see in the reconsideration process how that shakes out, whether it survives that process at all. I think there's, at least specifically as to the midstream sector, I think the jury's out because of the latest rule. But I think at a high level, I think your thinking is right that there is coordination and has been between those groups and the regulators.
So we like to kind of bring things to a close with a question that talks about the future, right? So, you know, you're on this podcast today here in 2025. You're back on in 3 years from now, let's just say, and you're happy about the way things are going. What has happened over those 3 years that has caused you to be happy? What, in your world, what would you like to see, or how would you like to see it?
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to see the administration move forward on a reasonably expeditious timeline with some of the tasks in front of them. They've got a lot that they want to take a closer look at. You know, particularly for our sector, there are some significant rules that they have said they're going to reconsider. And so I would be happy if they do that in a reasonably expeditious timeline so that, you know, when there is the inevitable legal challenge, there's time to get that done before there's another election. So, and I'd like to see a more collaborative approach where there are opportunities for that so that, you know, there are more win-wins and not just, you know, pounding by the government as using their enforcement hammer, but instead, you know, looking for solutions that allow us to do our job and be successful as a business and provide for the American people, but that we're doing that collaboratively and effectively.
Nice. Agreed. Trying to find the win-win is the difficult part in there, I think, sometimes. Well, Sam, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it. I feel like we could dig into more here, but I think we got the highlights covered and really appreciate your time.
Great. Well, thanks. Thanks for having me. This was fun. Really enjoyed it.
And for all our listeners out there, thanks for listening and catch us again on the next edition of the Let's Clear the Air Energy Podcast.
Thank you for listening to the Let's Clear the Air Energy Podcast. If you like what you have heard, subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcast app. You can email us with questions or comments to Let's Clear the Air Energy Podcast @gmail.com.